Hello, Will.
Hey, Rohan, how you doing?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Very well. And interestingly, we also have another Will today, or William. Hello, William.
Hello, both. I've been looking forward to this. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're very
Really
welcome.
good to have you on. Yeah.
So, what are we going to talk today, Will?
I'm assuming we're going with Will Williams, so I'll go ahead with that. Basically, as the title says, we're talking about revision. And I guess with a focus on how to approach that last term of the year, because of course, very often the first two terms of an academic year is all about trying to learn as much as possible. And when you come around to that last term, it might have actually been sort of 6 months since you've seen some of the content that you've got to now do an exam for. But how best to approach that? And of course, actually, William is a bit of an expert on that kind of side of things, which is why we've got him in to talk with us today.
Yeah, William, for the listeners who don't know, just give us a quick summary and your background.
Sure. So I studied experimental psychology at the other place to Will, regular Will. So I was at Cambridge with Rohan. Actually, we knew each other as part of our course, which was exciting. So one of the things that always bugged me once I got a certain way through the psychology course was the fact that somewhere deep within the second year, there's a lecture tucked away coming up towards exam term, just a single solitary lecture that basically runs you through how learning works and how you can get information locked away into memory efficiently. And I sat there in that lecture and I thought, well, this is completely ridiculous. This runs totally counter to everything else I've kind of done up until this point. And looking back at my, revision tactics through school, I just thought, oh, blimey, like I just wasted so much of my youth fundamentally techniques that don't really work. And so that always been a huge itch I wanted to scratch. It seemed like a huge opportunity to help the world study a little smarter through what we now understand about the science of learning and memory. So that ultimately led to what I do now. I run an exam, so I run a blog and a podcast of my own called Exam Study Expert. I help out with a bit of one-on-one coaching, and I also sort of go around schools and run revision workshops for students, as well as talking about the science of learning for teaching staff. So those are my main things.
Yeah, so
How
pretty
annoying
good
is it? You only
credentials.
had it halfway through your degree as well. It's a shame they don't do that on day one.
I know, right? And shame they don't do it for everybody, not just the people that choose experimental psych.
Will,
And
did you
as
have a similar lecture?
well, I don't think
Did
so.
you go to lectures?
I went to as many as I could. I think that's fair to say. But I was going to ask William, in terms of like how that lecture was framed, that wasn't a lecture that was this is to help you guys, right? It was more for the understanding of it rather than now go and apply this for yourself.
That's right. And I think that also raises a really interesting point that there are some scientists out there that, that research this stuff and do quite a nice job of outreach and trying to get, these messages out there. I think one of the challenges, particularly from, looking straight at the raw science, is that there's a bit of a gap between kind of understanding these principles and, okay, well, that makes sense. I can kind of read the science and, all right, yeah, I understand it. But then the gulf between that and actually putting it into practice and doing that consistently, from my experience and over the years kind of teaching this stuff, that gulf is quite a big gap to bridge. So that gap between theoretical understanding and actually changing your practice, changing your behaviors, is quite a big one. And that's part of the challenge of, what I'm trying to help people with.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess, because like you say, it's something that you learn so late on. By the time you get to the age where this matters, people are sort of entrenched, right? They've already got the sense of what they do and what works and how they learn. And presumably that's a bit of an uphill battle as well, trying to get over that first hurdle.
And even at school age, I talk to people even kind of coming up to their GCSEs. You might think that sort of feels like a relatively early stage in your academic journey. I'm sure that does to all three of us. But you talk to someone at this time in the year, so this is kind of late April, late April, May, exams are only a few weeks away. You know, if you're a committed GCSE candidate, you might have been, you know, already revising in previous holidays. You might have feel like you've got your technique down, you know, you've prepared for mocks in the past. And then, you know, someone comes along and says, actually, no, you know, don't do it like this, do it like this instead. You're like, you're kidding me. Like, I've done all this work. What? So one of the things I think that really helps is, you know, trying to find the smallest way you can change what you do today to make it into something that works really nicely. So one nice example of that is if you're someone that makes a lot of notes. So the first thing I'd want anybody to know about, like, how to learn effectively would be the power of retrieval practice, or active recall, as it's often referred to. It's the same thing. It means testing yourself on what you know, trying to pull knowledge out of memory. And people often get a little bit confused about note making. It's a really, really popular strategy. But, you know, people sit there kind of making their notes and they'll think, well, I'm revising actively because I'm writing something and I'm kind of putting it in my own words. But yes, it may be active, but it's not active recall. You're not trying to remember anything. You're not testing yourself on anything. You're not pulling any knowledge out of your memory. That's the key bit that consolidates the memory. So the little tip I have for anyone that likes to make a lot of notes is, fine, carry on making notes. No problem with that at all. Just make the small shift of starting to put a line down the middle of the page, dividing your notes into question and answer pairs. So you put questions down the left-hand side, answers down the right-hand side. Does two things for you. One, it means that when you are actually writing the notes, you can't get away with writing anything down without really thinking about the meaning of what you're writing, which can be a problem if you're kind of getting towards the end of a note-making session. Even if you're putting it in your own words or paraphrasing it, you might be not quite tuned into the actual meaning of what you're writing. And then the second thing, of course, you can use that for retrieval practice. So you can cover up that right-hand column, test yourself on the questions. It's a great way to do that active recall, that retrieval practice. Gosh, we've got very practical and very, very gritty quite quickly. I'm sorry.
So much value out of this podcast.
I went to university with this girl, very, very bright, but she had this incredible ability to write very quickly. Yeah. And her way of taking notes was she would literally write down what her supervisor or lecturer was saying verbatim, including their pauses and and I'm sorry. But it was just her way of, like, just if she didn't, then she would essentially disengage. So, but you're saying essentially the next step from that is to process it before you actually put it onto paper.
Yeah. So I think Daniel Willingham, who's, you know, cognitive psychologist, works in this space, has this nice little soundbite that memory is the residue of thought. So if you are kind of properly thinking about what you're writing down, and that discipline of having to split things into question and answer pairs is a nice way to make sure you're really thinking about it. You know, that's going to give you it's not going to do all the work of learning that thing for you, and it's not the end of the journey, but it's a really nice way to start.
My wife's a cognitive neuroscientist, and she's often saying that every time we think of a memory, we degrade it. Is that, how does that marry up with active recall and spaced repetition? And the more you think about it, the more likely you are to remember it.
So there's this really interesting dance between the world of psychology and the world of neuroscience. Psychologists, who I kind of associate myself with most, that's what I studied, that's kind of the world I inhabit day to day. Psychologists study kind of observable phenomena. So, you know, we can do experiments to test retrieval practice as a strategy for learning knowledge and how long the knowledge sticks and how well it sticks. It is one of the best and most robustly studied phenomena in all of psychology, let alone learning and memory psychology. Decades of, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of studies across all sorts of different types of learner, all sorts of different kinds of material, all sorts of different ways of doing retrieval practice. It holds up. Like, it's a really, really good thing to do. The experimental evidence is uncontroversial. That's the world of psychology. The world of neuroscience sort of tries to study, well, like, what's going on in the mechanics, like the wiring of the brain, the chemicals in the brain. And joining up those two areas is really hard. It's a really hard thing to do, to be able to figure out the neuro basis of some of these observable phenomena. So typically, kind of the neuro understanding, so to speak, tends to lag a bit behind kind of where we are in terms of our psych understanding of that, those kind of observable phenomena, just because the neuro bit is so much harder to figure out. What we do know is that when we, not just when we remember a fact, but when we're kind of exposed to a fact, to any little nugget of knowledge you care to think about, so it could be a specific word, or it could be, let's use the example of a specific date. So if you read the word 1066 on a page, famous year in history, or if you hear the word 1066 in your ears from me speaking it, that, whether it's coming through your eyes by reading it, whether it's coming through your ears by hearing it, that will light up the same little pattern of neurons, the same little neural circuit, that lights up, is the kind of circuit that codes for that little fact, 1066. Interestingly, that is exactly the same circuit that lights up when I ask you, what year was the Battle of Hastings? That little same little circuit lights up. Oh, it's 1066. Now, what kind of the kind of best understanding of what's going on in the kind of neuroscience of learning is that when we're learning things, we're forming what we call engrams. So an engram is essentially that little neural circuit codes for 1066. We're making the wiring of that circuit stronger. For those that care, that's happening at the level of the synapse, with particularly postsynaptic receptor. Increase in postsynaptic receptors to make the sort of synapses a bit more sensitive. In other words, we're kind of making it easier for that little neural circuit to light up. That's what learning is. So engrams, building those kind of stronger neural circuits that code for all these different facts that we need to know to pass our A levels or our med degrees or whatever we're doing. We kind of stretch a little bit more into speculation now, but as far as I can tell, and as far as kind of makes sense to me at least, what's kind of going on with the whole retrieval practice thing is that we are, when you try and light up that engram kind of from cold, if you like, by just trying to retrieve that fact, bring that fact to memory without external sensory input, that's sending a stronger signal to, you know, those synapses that, you know, this fact is important. We need to remember it. We need to strengthen this engram. Much more so than if we're exposing ourselves to sensory input by reading things over and over again, hearing it over and over again, or, you know, copying it out over and over again through note making. Long answer. Just to come back to the question you originally asked about the kind of degradation thing, it's interesting. There's plenty of evidence that memory is kind of malleable in some ways, and you know, any in kind of clinical settings where they work on sort of post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, you know, there are some really interesting examples of this. It's not quite my area, so I don't want to kind of talk with a great deal of authority, but it's certainly possible to kind of make memory malleable and sort of adjust it and play with it. But certainly from a kind of academic context, when we're trying to learn knowledge, hands down, retrieval practice is the best way to go.
Yes, I actually wanted to jump in on a couple of things there. I think what in terms of what Rohan, Aisha, your wife was saying, my understanding is that when you reactivate a memory, so that there's a theory that sort of when you reactivate memories, they are temporarily in this sort of malleable state, and then when they're unactivated, they're back and secured again. Yeah. And so whilst they're reactivated, the way that you presented it sounded as if every time you recall it, it degrades. I think the idea is when you reactivate it, it's got the possibility to degrade, but equally could be re-strengthened.
I think it would be misleading to say that if you try and remember something, that memory might fade more quickly. Like, that will never happen. Like, if you're doing your testing while you're learning, you know, for student listeners out there, if you're doing your testing while you're learning, if you're doing your retrieval practice, I absolutely don't want you going away with the idea that if I do my testing, oh, my memory might degrade. Yeah. And I'll lose it. No, that will never happen. Don't worry. But that point about the kind of the memory becoming slightly more malleable when you reactivate it, you know, that can help us understand why, you know, if we test ourselves on a fact and, oh, we got it wrong, say you're doing your Q&A notes, or Rohan, you mentioned you did a lot of flashcards, your Anki, that's, you know, great, another great way to do retrieval practice. You know, if you find out you got the answer wrong, in that moment, that's a nice way, as long as you look at what the right answer should have been, that's a nice way to kind of go in and adjust that memory and make sure you remember the right thing next time.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, it's not helpful knowing, oh, it's not this. Like, it's right. Better to know it is the, yeah, 1066 rather than it's not 1067, as an example.
Exactly.
And I think also in terms of like the way that the memory, the way that memories can be distorted is often not the memory itself, but sort of associated variables. So that they've do quite a few studies whereby instead of memorizing facts, people are told stories and then asked for, you know, to recall those stories or recall details from those stories. And often like the key things are maintained, but it's often sort of the small details which are lost or added to even. And, you know, that's why very often you hear of sort of wives' tales and myths changing every, you know, generation. It's because the key concepts are maintained, but the surrounding stuff is adjusted. But yeah, you know, obviously if you've got your, when you're doing your active recall, you then have someone to say to, or you have some information reminding you it's this, this, and this, then obviously you're able to reinforce that a lot better.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm a student in my final term. I've got either GCSEs or A-levels coming up. I've principally been kind of sledgehammering my revision techniques, or maybe even worse, ignoring them entirely, and just been writing stuff down over and over in the hopes that it diffuses through a process of osmosis somehow. How does, what would you say are like the top two or three things I can do to kind of have high impact but low effort?
So that, I want to come back to the point about low effort. So it's really interesting. But my, I like my top two or three ways to do retrieval practice would be, I mentioned two of them already. So do your Q&A notes. And that's a great strategy, particularly if you're already used to making a lot of notes. Like for some reason, it feels like a smaller behavioral shift just to start putting that line down the middle of the page. And so it's kind of easier to get over that hump and start, you know, actually putting it into practice. Flashcards can work really, really nicely as well. That was actually my personal go-to strategy. Rohan, I know you mentioned you used Anki quite heavily.
I think you got me to my medical degree. It was one of the, that Wikipedia was enough. So
yeah. Quizlet is also pretty popular these days. Both platforms work great. I was an old school guy, so I still have it under my desk to this day. I got this shoebox full of, you know, some, not all, but like edited highlights of all the flashcards I made, all the paper flashcards I made ahead of my final year, end of year exams. I think for me, part of the reason I liked paper flashcards is they're quite flexible. You know, I could put diagrams on the back really quickly. I could, you know, put equations. I could, you know, I could, it was quite quick to sort of scribble things out. You know, I could put knowledge in little boxes if I wanted to.
And how did you maintain the, because obviously flashcards are great, but the good thing about Anki is it then takes care of the spaced repetition side of things.
Yeah.
Did you manage that process yourself, or did you have like a system to space the flashcards out?
So if for those of you who were paying attention earlier, you may have noticed that I said the first thing I would love anybody to know about how to learn effectively is retrieval practice. We've kind of been talking about this for a little while now. The second thing is absolutely that point about spaced learning. So if you do your retrieval practice once, one day, chances are that's not going to stick for the long term. We need to come back to it, repeat it on different days. And it's that magic combination of retrieval practice and spacing. So coming back and retesting yourself on different days, not just flipping through your notes again on a different day, like actually testing yourself on different days, that really gets the knowledge to stick. So in the context of kind of my paper flashcards, or you know, if you're doing your Q&A notes, whatever, spaced learning, it's quite an easy principle to understand. Okay, well, I need to spread it out. I need to do it on different days. But of the two principles, so retrieval practice and spacing, it's spacing that tends to be much the harder one to actually put into practice and do, because it raises all sorts of practical questions like, well, okay, how many times do I need to come back to it? How big do I need to make the gaps between the spacings? Unless I'm not using something like Anki, do I need to kind of come up with some elaborate tracking table? So I did this topic for the first time on April the 22nd. I need to do it again on the 23rd, and again on the 27th, and again on May the 14th. And like, I do that for every single subtopic. And like, whoa, that's incredibly complicated. It gets incredibly complicated incredibly quickly. I don't really like things when they get incredibly complicated, because it means it's very hard for us to do them. Again, I like to make things simple, so we can actually do them. So the way I kind of stumbled on to make spacing simple for me, and it's become a kind of core part of what I teach now, is like building little windows for spacing right into your routine. So most people tend to study in blocks of time, like half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour at a time before having a little break. So what I would do is, and this was my spacing schedule. There's no one size fits all. We can talk about that again in a minute if you want. This was my spacing schedule. It's what worked for me. I do about an hour at a time. So let's say I'd done about an hour of making new flashcards on the topic. Just before I went and had a break, I'd grab 5 minutes and just retest myself on all the flashcards I'd just made. I'd go away, have a couple of minutes break, walk around a bit, refill the water, come back to the desk. And the first thing I did before making any new flashcards was test myself again on all the flashcards I had just made before the break. So I was like 10 minutes in and I'd already done two rounds of spaced repetition. I did a third one at the end of the day. So the last block of the day, the last kind of hour of the day, I didn't do any new flashcards at all. I just retested myself on all the new cards from today. Repetition number three. Repetition number four came the following morning. The first block of the new morning was testing myself on everything I did yesterday. So I was 24 hours in. I'd already got four repetitions in. And then I'd also
sounds like you're going to the gym when you're talking about it, actually.
Like, sports is a great analogy. Like, you're almost like working out your memory muscle, aren't you? Yeah. And then the fifth one would come at the end of the week. I think I'd often do like Sunday morning. I wouldn't do anything new. I'd do a half day. I'd do a short day on a Sunday, have a knock off kind of 3 o'clock or something. Go and sing in chapel choir in my case. I'd spend that morning, you know, again, not doing anything new, just retesting myself on all the cards I'd done that week. So it meant that I didn't have to have any elaborate tracking tables. It didn't mean I had to, you know, be kind of like, you know, trying to keep track of all, you know, all the things I'd done. My kind of routine just prompted me at these little points. Okay, it's 5 minutes before a break. I've just come back from a break. It's the last block of the day. It's the first block of the day. It's Sunday morning. Each time that was my window. That's my opportunity to do the spacing. I knew what I needed to do in that time.
And I suppose in terms of, you know, using Anki as the sort of digital comparison, yeah. Whilst Anki is very complicated, or it seems very complicated, ultimately all it does is, depending on how hard you found it, it puts that flashcard either near to the top of the pack or to the bottom. And you could, you know, once you've got a, because the sort of process that you've described, William, is like when you're making the flashcards, but once you've got sort of a full deck and you're thinking, well, how on earth do I approach this? I suppose you can do that algorithm very easily by just, depending on how hard you found that one, either put it part of the way down the pack, or right, if it was really easy, just put it right at the bottom and you won't see it for a while. Which I guess is not overly complicated and sort of is a decent version of it.
Yeah,
I guess you'd need like a few tiers, wouldn't you? Because there might be something that you found good, but then if you put it right to the bottom, you may see it in a month's time potentially.
Yeah, you might need to have some kind of stratification system, but yeah, which adds complication.
So again, I like to keep it simple. I actually didn't have loose flashcards, and this may seem like a bit of a random sort of nitty gritty detail to bring up, but I think it's quite an interesting point to think about. So I used spiral bound flashcards, which meant they always stayed in order. And I found that was quite nice, particularly for a lot of this kind of content I was learning, there tended to be a flow to it. There tended to be a sequence to it. Things later on in the lecture built on things earlier on in the lecture. And ultimately when it came to writing essays on it, that was kind of the order in which I'd want to surface things. And when we're learning things, it does tend to be easier if we're kind of getting used to associating knowledge together in the sort of way we might want to ultimately use it. You know, if it's something completely disparate, like, I don't know, language vocab is probably not a bad example, then sure, you know, absolutely all jumbled up all over the place. Like, it's not going to make too much difference. But anytime there is some kind of logic or some kind of structure to the knowledge, I've got a strong preference for keeping it in order. I know different things work for different people and different contexts, but that was my preference. So, you know, that point about, well, what happens if I found a flashcard hard? Well, I'd probably go through it. Like, if there's a flashcard I couldn't do, I'd generally have a second crack at it right there in that session. Or maybe I'd skip a flashcard, you know, I'd go on to the next flashcard, have a go at that, and then come back to the previous one if I knew that I'd struggled with it. If it was quite a complex flashcard, so it had a sort of complex diagram on the back, or there was like a list of, you know, five factors or six issues I just needed to know. So, you know, relatively challenging knowledge exercise, you know, I might need to drill myself on that 2, 3, 4 times before it started to stick. 2, 3, 4 cycles of having a go, trying to remember it, looking back at the answer, going, oh yeah, that was what I missed, trying again. So I'd be kind of doing that as I went along. The kind of point about prioritization gets quite interesting when you're thinking about, and I know we're talking about all in the context of the last term. Like if we fast forward a little bit to the last, you know, week or two before an exam, you know, that's ideally maybe a couple of weeks out, you have enough time to go through all your flashcards, all your materials, that you've, all your Q&A notes, whatever you've done, and do a pass on kind of everything. Sometimes that's not possible, but let's assume it is. Certainly was for me and kind of taking a psychology final. That might take several days to go through literally everything. But then I might highlight, maybe I'll dog-ear the corner or something, fold the corner over. Maybe I'll even just scribble it out on a fresh piece of paper. I'll just highlight all the things. Maybe it's 10, 20, 30% of the cards that I got wrong at that kind of going through everything 2 weeks out point. And then that's kind of my shortlist of priority things to go through now, perhaps with just 2 or 3 days to go before the exam. So, you know, I'm gradually kind of whittling down and down and down, and maybe I'll go through that process again. So I get down to just maybe a handful of questions that are really not sticking in memory. And, you know, that might be what I go through just the afternoon before the paper or the morning before an afternoon paper. So I sometimes think of it as like a funnel. You start with everything a couple of weeks out from the exam, and you gradually kind of, you know, bring things down and down the funnel until you've just got your kind of top priority things, those things that just aren't sticking, that you're kind of going through in a couple of hours, the afternoon or the morning before the paper.
Well, so that's a really good process. And obviously you talk about paper singular, because one of the problems that I certainly had in my second year was when you have back-to-back exams and trying to sort of, because in my mind, it's much easier to sort of have separate things that you're focusing on at a time. But that's so difficult when one day you've got exam one and the next day you've got exam two. And I don't, you know, is there a good approach for that? Does it change if your exams are all clustered together?
The top thing I'd say about this, I think, is be intentional. So most of the time when you get a list, you know, your exam timetable for exam season, it's a, you know, a printout or an email, PDF or whatever that has, you know, line by line, this is the paper, this is where it is, this is the time. Now, I find that kind of information, formative information, quite hard to work with. And I kind of like to see where my white spaces are. I just like to see it a bit more visually. So the first thing I'll do is convert that into a kind of a table. So I'll do columns for each day, row for morning, row for afternoon, and then I'll write the papers in. That's step one. Nothing revolutionary so far. I'm sure a lot of people probably do something similar. But what I then go and do, and I haven't really come across anyone else that kind of does this. I don't know. Maybe one of you two did it. I don't know. but then what I'll do is I'll go in and I'll plan out. So for the white space, I'll plan in which papers I'm doing my final prep for at given points. So you know, if I've got an afternoon exam, the morning before that exam, you know, that would typically be prep for that afternoon's exam, unless the following day has a paper in the morning and the afternoon. So I've got an afternoon paper day one, going into a double day tomorrow with a paper in the morning and the paper in the afternoon. In which case, I might divide my time in that morning before the first day. I might divide that three ways. So a bit of time on all three papers that day, the afternoon, the following morning, the following afternoon. I can't kind of give you the golden formula. I need to look at your exam timetable. But I think, you know, with a degree of common sense, when you start to map this out and start to make these decisions in advance, where am I going to put my final prep? You know, you can start to make some reasonably sensible and intelligent decisions.
Yeah.
You're going to look really silly now, Will, if you don't do amazing in your masters based on all these tips.
Well, with all this advice, how could I not? Exactly. So one other phenomenon that I noticed at exams was, as everyone was waiting in exam schools, sort of to be allowed in, you've even got a few people there still hurriedly rushing through their notes. And I was always of the opinion, if you've not got it by then, you know, you've not got it. But is there, and this isn't a good message to be putting across, but is there any value to that sort of last 5 minutes before an exam, or should you really just relax and give yourself the time off?
So I've got something to say on this. I don't know if you've got different opinions.
You go first, Rohan.
So I was one of these people who would do this only in specific exams, but it wasn't I think like people fall into two categories. The one is just like people who are quite anxious, and it was like that book is almost like a comfort blanket for them before they go into the exam hall. For me, it was a bit more strategic. So with the medical exams in particular, they are quite memory heavy. And they're just very fact-based. And there was a few diagrams, which I just, despite my best efforts, just could not never recall fully. So what I used to do was, for the exams where I knew I'd have to like whip out these diagrams at some point in the exam, is I would essentially take the diagrams with me into the hall, look at them for about 2 or 3 minutes. As soon as they allowed us to go in, I'd rush to my desk, and then I'd write down everything. And essentially, it was one of those, I'd put it into my short-term memory, and then it was in front of me for my paper. And obviously they give you, scrap paper that you can use as well. So that was like my version of it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you've done that, William.
I have to admit, I sometimes did something similar. Not always, but there were times where I'd do something like that. Because short-term memory does work. Like, we can rely on short-term memory is a thing. It's much easier to remember things that you were talking about 5 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago or half an hour ago than it is to remember something from 2 months ago. The main caveat I'd give is don't rely on your short-term memory. Like, don't rely on cramming the day before or the morning before a paper. The thing you're talking about, Rohan, like that's sometimes a that can apply in a number of different circumstances. So, I used something similar when I was doing my A-level further maths. We had a lot of formulas to learn. And what I'd essentially do is I'd go into that exam, and the first thing I did was basically write my cheat sheet. I wasn't cheating, but, I'd sit down at the paper, and as soon as we were allowed to start, I wouldn't even open the paper. I'd just scribble down, all the formulas, basically one side of A4, the rough A4 you get in an exam. And those were then all the formulas I needed for the paper. It was very comforting. At that point, I don't think I was doing the, learning it, literally just moments before the exam. I think I had that formula sheet down, well in advance. And so I kind of didn't need to look at it just before. But that kind of principle can apply to a range of subjects.
Yeah. I guess short-term memory is short-term, and therefore you can't put everything into short-term memory.
Right. Yeah. And the other way I used it was, I remember describing that kind of funnel. I'd often end up with getting down to like a side or two of A4 of just, these are the absolute like key facts that for whatever reason are just really struggling to get them to stick. I might have a look through that, a final kind of look over, maybe even a final kind of test myself of those facts, just outside the exam hall. Sometimes, not always, partly depends on how I was feeling about the paper. If I was feeling a bit, generally sort of stressed and nervy about it, I wouldn't do that, because that's just going to put my head in the wrong place and I'm going to be kind of off my game. I definitely do that sometimes too.
Yeah. So that all sounds good. The other thing I wanted to kind of get both of your opinions on was when I was using Anki, there were some bit easy cards, which were very straightforward to remember, but there were some cards which I thought I'd remembered, and then they'd come around in a week's time, and then I'd get them wrong, and then the whole process would start again. And Anki had this feature where if you forgot a card 4 or 5 times, then it would label it as something called a leech. And it would just remove it from your deck and say that you need to change the card, because clearly you've forgotten it so many times that the card is a bad card or you're struggling with it. And then I would like split the card up into various things. But is that psychology speak? Is that just an Anki term? And how do we tackle leeches?
I never heard the term leech before. But certainly, I generally say if there's a question you're struggling to remember over and over and over again, it's probably a sign that, I think you mentioned you might break the card up. Generally, I like to see short questions, short answers wherever possible. Some of my favorite flashcards are just a single word or just a couple of words, a single number. Those are amazing flashcards. Like, don't write essays in response to questions. That's not the point of a flashcard. Keep it as tight as possible. But there do come some circumstances where you just can't break it up anymore. You need to know, what are the like six factors that affect this thing, or like what are the I don't know, 8 symptoms of a certain disease or whatever it is. You can't break that up over separate cards. So I generally take that as a trigger, you know, particularly if I'm getting it wrong a few times. I'd sit back and go, well, okay, how can I remember this? What tricks can I use to help me remember it? And, you know, I'd often do something along the lines of, well, okay, if it's like a list of 6 things or 8 things, you know, what are the key words within each one? Do the keywords happen to spell out a nice word? Well, that would be a nice gift. Most of the time it doesn't. So you need to be a bit cleverer. You know, can you group the keywords into themes? So I don't know, there's 3, I don't know, blood related symptoms and like 2 mental ones, cognitive ones, and 2 like skin ones. I don't know. So kind of group them into themes, just give yourself some kind of structure to help you trigger the memories of the details. Or maybe, you know, again, back to the kind of the first letters of the keywords, you know, do they spell out any, even if it's not a real word, is it sort of a pronounceable word? Shortly after university, I found myself teaching, tutoring in business studies for something I'd done a little bit along the way as well. And, you know, I still remember to this day, the parts of an income statement per the, I think, EdExcel A-level syllabus at the time are Argon VFIT, starting for revenue, gross profit, operating profit, net profit, variable costs, interest, tax. Variable costs, fixed cost, interest, tax. I still remember that. You know, it's not a real word, but it helps me remember it.
Yeah.
Even if it's not pronounceable, can you look for acronyms that are familiar? So, you know, first letters of people's names, you know, SVR was a boss I had one time way back in the day in a corporate job shortly after university, before I did what I do now. KFC, you know, IBM, like any kind of little acronyms that are sort of recognizable, you know, look out for those. Look out for those and kind of try and find ways to make them, make them clues. What you're really trying to do here is, you know, if you think about, to use the sort of metaphor of recall being the process of recalling something, being, you know, standing on one bank of a river and kind of leaping across the river to the other bank. So the bank of remembering. What you're kind of really trying to do with all this stuff, mnemonics in general, is it's kind of put stepping stones in the middle of the river. So you don't have to leap across it in one go. You kind of leap across onto the stepping stone, your kind of clue or cue, and then you can leap across the full remembering. So any of these little strategies you can use. And with practice, you know, these can become second nature.
Yeah. And in terms of, just for the listeners, like, would you be able to define like plasticity in terms of like layman term?
Yes.
Yeah, that follows through. I think you made it, I think I understand it less now, but in greater detail. So, like, I mean, just to kind of come to an overall summary, I mean, we can talk about this for a very long time, but any kind of last minute tips for students who do have exams coming up that we've not already covered?
Yeah, so just to, like, to summarize, do your retrieval practice, test yourself, spend as much time of your revision time as possible testing yourself, pulling things out of memory. And don't be confused that, like, you need to learn things and then test yourself. No, the testing is the learning, and you will get things wrong and you won't remember things. That's fine. That's part of the process. You then look at the right answer and have another go, either straight away or another day. And then, yeah, have another go, even if you got it right. So do the space learning thing. Come back to it again that evening, the next morning, on your Sunday morning, whatever you want to do. And I think that one of the things I'd want to emphasize on all this is kind of back to a kind of little phrase you could have used earlier around, which was quite interesting. You talked about things being low effort. Spaced retrieval practice is not low effort in the moment. It is high intensity. It demands a lot of concentration and focus. And that's one of the reasons people don't do it as much as they should. Now, to go back to the point you made earlier, things are a bit like a workout, or it's a bit like sort of training, you know, for sports or something. That analogy can be quite helpful here. If you're doing a really low intensity workout, so you just go for a little stroll in the park, yeah, sure, like it's no harm in it, you know, but you're not going to really ramp up your kind of cardiovascular power and, you know, build a really strong heart and lungs and, you know, leg muscles and all the rest of it by just kind of taking a gentle stroll. You know, you want to be doing something that has a bit more intensity and high intensity interval training or something is, you know, puts your body under quite a lot of stress for quite short periods of time. Get amazing results for your body, but in quite short spaces of time. Same kind of idea with memory, I would argue. So when you're doing your spaced retrieval practice, it does require more focus and concentration and intensity in the moment, but you can get amazing results for your memory in a much more time efficient way. So a lot of what I talk about can really be summed up by the idea of, you know, I want people to study smarter, not harder. And that's a kind of, you know, double-edged coin. And, you know, studying smarter, so using your spaced retrieval practice, among other things, you know, allows you to study less hard. You know, you don't have to stay up all night anymore. You know, you can get your work done in kind of reasonable amounts of time. But it kind of goes the other way as well, because by not studying so hard, by kind of having a more reasonable work-life balance, that allows you to have the energy and the focus to bring to your work when you do sit down at your desk and to ramp up your intensity and therefore to study harder, study smarter, sorry. So it kind of works together as a complete system. You end up with a better work-life balance, you end up with better grades, you're less stressed, you're happier, and you're kind of more successful. It's like a win-win-win-win-win. Yeah, I do. I was thinking about this earlier and I noticed it was Earth Day 2022. So in that spirit, I've got a fun fact today that might allow us all together to perhaps save a few trees through a cunning little everyday life hack. So, you know, the paper towels you get in public bathrooms, right? So how many do you typically take at a time to dry your hands? Like for me, it's like 2, 3, 4, maybe like a whole handful in some circumstances. America alone, I understand, gets through about 6 billion kilos of paper towels every single year. So the kind of collective impact of us using fewer paper towels could be quite significant. The trick to using just one paper towel, one single paper towel to get that nice dry hand feeling is all in the combination of shake and fold. So you want to shake your hands a good number of times, maybe 8 at the sink, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 to get rid of all that loose water. Then you take your single paper towel and you fold it. You fold it neatly in half, proceed to dry your hands. And the folding, something about the folding helps the towel absorb much more water due to a phenomenon that single paper towel use evangelist Joe Smith calls interstitial suspension, by which I think he basically means that water can get trapped more easily between the layers, as well as within the actual fabric of the towel itself. So, nice little everyday hack there to potentially save quite an enormous number of trees if we kind of spread the good word and get the word out there. And if I may, I'd just like to add one bonus Earth Day themed fact for those of you interested in taking your planet saving duties even more seriously. There's an organization called the World Land Trust, who I supported for many years, who to date have bought and preserved around 2.5 million acres of prime rainforest. It's kind of one of the most efficient kind of environmental charities out there. Regularly kind of appears on kind of best buy lists of kind of really effective, really, really effective causes to support in the kind of environmental space. Patrons include Sir David Attenborough himself, among others. You know, I think not a lot of people know about them because they don't really spend anything on marketing. They just, you know, take donor money and buy rainforest with it. So, you know, if you're ever looking for a cause to support in the kind of Earth Day environmental space, definitely put in a good word for the World Land Trust.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we need another podcast episode with just you telling us about life hacks, to be honest. Will, over to you. Very And how does that make you feel? Yeah. Well, here's my fact should make you feel even smaller, but not because. But I think it will make all of us feel smaller. So I was talking a little bit and doing some work on cyber research, and basically, obviously, with what's been happening in Ukraine and cyber warfare, I didn't realize how advanced cyber hacking had become. So initially, what used to happen is you'd have like a coder sitting somewhere, and then essentially they'd find a vulnerability called a backdoor, and essentially they would then exploit that vulnerability by changing a website or like turning something on or off. And often it was because these things are very hard to find. Most people would only find like one or two in like a reasonable time scale. But then this security company, what they started to do was they started to pay hackers to tell them the exploits. And then they would go to the company and say, well, you've got an exploit here. We'll tell you where as long as you pay us $10,000, $100,000. And then they'd pay the hackers. So that was called ethical hacking. But what emerged essentially in 2004 was there was a bug that infected, or there was a virus that infected about 60% of all of Iran's computers. And you can probably see where I'm going with this. And typically viruses before then only used one vulnerability, but this one was really special because it used four. all which were required, because the idea of this one was it would sneak into a computer. It didn't need to be executed. As soon as you viewed it, it would just spread. It would spread to all computers without anyone knowing. And it wouldn't do anything to computers. Its ultimate aim was to get into the nuclear reactor near Tehran. And then you might think I was going to try and make it explode. No, it was far more innocuous. It basically increased the velocity of the centrifuges. I think they normally run about 700. It increased them to 1400 for about a week and then dropped them down to like 5 the next week. So yeah, still averaged out 700. And obviously those changes in speed and the fact that they're operating at very different speeds to what they're meant to basically meant that the nuclear reactors and the centrifuges would get destroyed a lot quicker. So they're reducing the life expectancy. Now you might be thinking this is a very advanced thing for a hacking group to do. And essentially after like significant research and leaks, essentially emerged that Obama had ordered it as a way of like slowing down Iran's nuclear program, which I thought was just mind-boggling, that the level of, like, yeah, exactly, right? Like that level of cyber hacking. So this, I think they said, well, we can't do nothing, but we also can't like do an airstrike on this nuclear plant. But the crazy thing is that it wouldn't have to tell anyone. Like Obama or the US government could have denied involvement, which I think is quite scary. So on that great end, really nice seeing you, Will. And William, thank you so much for helping our students.
Been a real pleasure. Wishing everyone every success in their exams. And enjoyed the conversation. And great facts, by the way. Great facts.
William, would you like to just give us a quick 30-second spiel about your own podcast before we wrap things up?
Yeah, sure. So you're obviously listening to a podcast, so you like podcasts. Feel free to search for the Exam Study Experts podcast, where I chat about, you know, all the things we touched on today and a lot more, with, you know, anything in regards to sort of studying effectively, from kind of productivity, time management, routine strategies through to kind of exam technique and things you can do in the exam hall itself to boost your mark, as well as, of course, all the things we've been talking about, effective ways to revise, flashcards, Q&A notes, and many more strategies that I would also recommend for different circumstances. So feel free to check that out. Or if you prefer your information in book form, I've got a couple of books that summarize it as well. So Outsmart Your Studies is all about studying and revising. Outsmart Your Exams is all about the exam technique stuff.
Wonderful. And next week, please join us for what is proving to be quite a big story in the NHS, which is we have too many doctors. What are we going to do with them? Well, too many medical students to become doctors. But thanks, gentlemen. Have a lovely week.
Thanks very much.